Hervorragend. Welcome back to the university. I hope you all had a good time passing between the years. I think last time we stopped somewhere around these slides on MPI. I decided to drop the MPI coding example from the lecture. If anyone's interested in that, we can do that in the exercises. But I would like to continue now with the actual content of the lecture, simply because I realized that we don't have as much time as I was expecting in this term left. I think usually the teaching time of the winter term runs until early or even mid of February. This year it will end on the end of January. So we have one or two lectures less than I was expecting. So let's just continue. Okay, we will now continue with the review of the fastest systems of the top 500 list. And we are currently in November 2009, and we are looking at Jaguar. Jaguar was located at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. It was surpassing the previous fastest system, which was Roadrunner. Roadrunner was not really a system which was loved by programmers, as I said last time. Actually, Jaguar was a rather convenient system to program for because it was just standard Opteron processors, no accelerators, no really complicated architecture. It was a more or less a standard Cray system. So it was not one of a kind, but it was rather simply something which everyone else bought at that time, just a slightly bigger version of it. And also it was quite a lot faster than Roadrunner. I think Roadrunner had 1.1 petaflops, so this is a step up of about 60%, quite a lot. However, it did stay on the top 500 list just for 1 year when Kyung Ho, I think no one here can correct me, so I can claim that it was a correct pronunciation. Tianhe 1A surpassed it just 1 year later. I said before that the architecture is more or less standard. And I think if we go back the past, probably even the past 10 years and look at all Cray systems, we will always see some sort of 3D torus network. And the version that Jaguar was using was the C-Star network, which had per 3D direction or per cardinal dimension 9.6 gigabytes bandwidth per second. It had a dedicated processor for managing network traffic, and each node was connected via a 6.4 gigabyte link. Now, if you look at this, you may wonder, why would I have a slower link to connect the node to when my network here is actually faster? Why would I ever need a higher bandwidth here? And the reason for that is, of course, I have a torus network. So I might have to route traffic from neighboring nodes through this node. So these 9.6 gigabytes are not exclusively for the connected node, but it might need to share it if I'm not using just next neighbor communication. That's the reason for that. Okay, and I had two Opteron processors connected to this network link, and each had its own RAM. That's just to be expected because we have a cache-coherent, non-uniform memory access, or CC-NUMA architecture, just like every multi-core dual-socket design today in all supercomputers has. I think except for BlueJeanQ, which has just a single socket per node. What is interesting, I think this is the first slide in this lecture we see on the cooling system. Actually, the cooling system was rather important for Jaguar to achieve a much better power efficiency than Roadrunner. And what they did was they were using a sort of liquid cooling where they had an evaporator. And they did lead the coolant flow from the bottom to the top of the rack. And on the top of the rack, the hot coolant would be cooled back. Hello. what's similar in this architecture to the blue gene architectures we've seen before, or to the Roadrunner architectures, is the modular and hierarchical design. So compute blades did consist of multiple nodes. So in this case, we have 4 nodes per blade. We had 8 blades per chassis and 3 chassis per rack. So that's actually similar to Roadrunner. They were using, I think, standard 19-inch racks. And if we try to visualize this, you can already tell that per rack, that's a lot of nodes, right? So, and of course, they didn't stop at one rack, but they had a lot of racks. Actually, I think Roadrunner, if it hadn't been upgraded later on, would still be in the top 10 for the fastest systems. Actually, they did later on. They didn't scrap the whole system, and they rather upgraded it. But we'll see that later on in the lecture. What's also interesting is if we visualize each node as such a bubble here, we can also visualize the I/O nodes here as yellow bubbles, and the red bubbles are, I think, the interconnects to the external network. So if you want to do I/O on this system efficiently, what you have to do is you have to accumulate the data you want to write to disk on certain nodes and let those nodes handle the output, which is of course a programmer burden, right? You cannot, or you shouldn't, for performance reason, you shouldn't call on each node MPIO file open, but you should move the data or concentrate the data first on certain nodes, which is from a architectural point of view interesting, because I/O seems to still be in sort of an open problem, in the sense that there's no generic solution to I/O, but more or less for each system we see, or at least for each architecture we see, a different approach to I/O. Some systems use this approach where only certain nodes have access to the I/O network. Some other systems would distribute I/O through all nodes. Sometimes we see systems, although none of these are in the upper part of the top 500, where you really have just one file server. That usually doesn't scale, so that's a design which is slowly dying out now. Okay. Hi. If we look beyond Jaguar, this is the Jaguar system. At Oak Ridge, there were at that time, of course, a lot more systems. So they still had an older Cray XT4 system. They had Spider, which is, I think, a storage network. They had a couple of login nodes, and they also had a couple of specialized systems, for instance, so-called Powerwall, which is basically a huge display for which you could use for 3D projections. And all of these systems were connected by 4X DDR InfiniBand. I think this is still the same network they are using today, at least externally. So when we were talking about networks, I think I said that InfiniBand is a high-performance network, and high-performance networks usually don't emphasize compatibility, because they are usually just built for one system. And externally, you may connect them via Ethernet. But in this case, they chose InfiniBand simply because it's faster than the Ethernet choices you typically get. Okay, I said before that Jaguar was replaced as the fastest system pretty quickly, just 1 year after it was inaugurated. So the next system was even just for a shorter time in the top one spot. This is Tianhe 1A. Okay, no objections for the pronunciation, I'm very glad. The system is, I think it was the first Chinese system on the top 500 list number one spot. So people were surprised. They were not exactly expecting it. Back then, China was still treated as a developing country in terms of supercomputing, which of course today has changed a lot. And people back then said, oh, well, basically they just bought US tech, Intel Nehalem cores and NVIDIA Tesla accelerators. Today, if you look at current Chinese systems, they also use homegrown hardware, so they are catching up. The system itself was quite a bit faster than Jaguar. Jaguar had 1.7 something, and Tianhe 1A had 2.5 petaflops. What's interesting here is, I think, the budget. I'm not sure what the budget was, but it was supposed quite a lot less than what Jaguar was using. So it was a rather cheap system. And the reason for that is they got a lot of power out of the Tesla cards. And even though Tesla cards sell at a couple thousand dollars per piece, it was still cheaper than using a lot of nodes. And I think in this case, they were just using around 7,000 nodes. So if we compare this with Jaguar, I think Jaguar had quite a lot more nodes. I should have written down the number of nodes here as well. I don't remember those now. Okay, we could deduce it from here. That would be 12 times. So it's about 12,000 nodes for Jaguar. And Tianhe just had about 7,000 nodes, even though it had much more performance. Okay, one problem was the system itself, I think it wasn't used so much for scientific calculations. So it was idling for the most time. And I think they even had to shut it down after a while because the system itself was paid for from a different fund than the maintenance would be paid for. So actually they had to power it down for a couple of months. And it was, that's usually catastrophic for a supercomputer because these machines are expected to run and run and run. And if they are powered down, depending on where your compute center is, if you power down, also the air condition, humidity gets into the system, and that's a problem. Okay, I said before that Tianhe was not the fastest system for too long. Actually, it was replaced just half a year later by the K computer. K computer, this was a Chinese, no, it was a Japanese system. Interesting thing here is it's not in the common sense a standard architecture. It's not an Intel architecture. It's not Intel compatible architecture. But it was a Spark design, and it was built by Fujitsu. Initially, the system was planned to be a joint venture from Fujitsu, NEC and Hitachi, but NEC and Hitachi dropped out of the deal because they thought they weren't able to build the system, or they weren't able to produce the parts they were contracted to build to. But Fujitsu stayed in and they said, okay, we'll build the system ourselves. What's interesting about this system is it's completely Japanese, the whole hardware. It's a custom interconnect, the TOFU interconnect. It's a more or less, Spark is not a custom architecture, but they built or adapted the chip themselves. There's no American hardware in that. What's also interesting is initially they were able to run the system at 8.5, later on at 10.5 petaflops, and that's a huge, I think that's a factor of 4 compared to the previous system, compared to Tianhe 1A. So that's again a huge step up. If you remember, we did open the discussion of the fastest system with the Earth simulator, which was also a Japanese system, which was also in a sense a shock to the community because it was so much faster than its predecessor, ASCII RED, I think. And again, this is a system which was so much faster than the previous systems. It was a really, really huge surprise. But what's also a surprise is, of course, the budget, because that machine was expensive. 1.2 billion, that's about 5 times more expensive than Jaguar. So that's quite a lot. So this is probably not a system which is sustainable in the sense that you can build such a system again in 2 years, because that would be, even for the Japanese, too much money. But the reason why they invested so much money into this system was they thought, okay, this will spread out and enable us to do other businesses. But as far as I know, Fujitsu is not selling this technology very well. So they are, in the world, perhaps a handful of systems of this architecture. So I'm not sure if that was enough to make up for the 1.2 billion. Anyhow, the node architecture itself is interesting in its own sense, because they were using a combination of air cooling and liquid cooling. So this is a picture of a rack, and what's probably not well visible in this photo, but should be visible in this photo, is how the nodes themselves are mounted in an angle inside the rack. So if we would look at the rack from top to bottom, we would see that the nodes are slightly angled. And the reason for that is they want to use liquid cooling and air cooling. In this case, they can use they can move some air past the node. I still think that you could probably do it the same with a mounting which is perpendicular to the rack itself, but I didn't design it, so they probably know better. Okay, I said before that they were using liquid cooling. Liquid cooling is used for the CPUs, not for the RAM, which is interesting. I think if you look at SuperMUC in Munich, you will see that SuperMUC also cools the RAM chips. And these are the network chips. They are also liquid cooled. What's interesting here about the liquid cooling is they are drop resistant. So you can just pull a tube or a pipe, and there will no water be leaking out of that, which is sort of important if you're running a, if you're working on a running computer system, right? Because it's all, there's always power somewhere. I think I did even take this photo myself. They had the racks at SC13 in Denver. So usually if you go to the supercomputing conference in the US, all the big manufacturers, all the big vendors will have samples of their hardware. Usually you're not allowed to touch the hardware, of course, because it's sort of expensive. Did I show you pictures of the K computer facility? Okay, so no one's nodding, so we can't. Did I? Yeah. Maybe. These? Okay. In any case, so no matter if we've already seen those, we can. I really like those pictures, so we can take a look again. Okay, so as you may know, the weather in Japan tends to be sometimes a bit nicer than our summer. I was there, I think, a bit more than about 2.5 years ago, I was there in Kobe at a conference. And it was summer. Summer in Japan is very hot. But they somehow decided to make the best of it. And so the facility itself is very nice. Actually, this is on top of the K computer facility. And what you see in the background is the airport of Kobe, which is located on a small island in the sea. And what you can see here connecting is the railway, which connects the airport and the city. And the same railway, they dub it subway, although it's running on pillars, has its own station for the K computer. So I think it's still the first supercomputer which has its own subway station, which is interesting. What's also interesting is when you can't read these characters, these signs, you don't know which is leading up and which is leading down. So sometimes it's confusing and you just enter a lift and press all buttons hoping that one will lead you to the right way. What's also interesting is they didn't just put all those racks in some basement room, but they built a huge building for the whole system. I have some other pictures of the building itself, and they added a room which is just dedicated to show the system to visitors. So because we were there for a conference, they of course led all the visitors of the conference to this room to allow us to take pictures of the system. And I had my daughter with us. Today she's much larger, much taller. It's sometimes confusing to see her being that small because I just can't remember that. Anyhow, so one thing that's interesting for me is how different the system design. Clearly, they spend a lot of time to make the system look nice. Is from American systems. American systems. I think, yeah, what's, how do you say schlicht in English? I think the system itself, even though it's impressive, is much more humble than competing American systems. But yeah, as I said, they spend a lot of effort. This is the building in which the system is located. The system is located on the top floor, and there are also offices located in the building. And I think the subway station is somewhere here in front. And this is this building here is just for cooling and for power supply. They build. This is actually in scale model. So if you got into the building on the ground floor, this scale model is located. And if you press a button, you could slide down half of the model. So you could look inside the building. And what you can see here is on the top floor, we have the system. On, I think here is the storage system located two floors down. Yeah, and as I said here, we have cooling in the auxiliary building. That's not so nice looking, so there's another wall outside to hide all the pipes and stoves. Yeah. Sorry, I can't translate this. But what you can see here is this is the observation chamber. Some more information on here. Cooling and power supply. I think it's mainly cooling and to a lesser degree power supply. And I'm just showing these pictures because I was amazed how much detail they put into the model itself. Yeah, this is the subway station. Quite close to this facility was an IKEA. I don't know how to pronounce that in English. They had a lot of parks, but they didn't allow people to barbecue there. Right behind the sign, someone was barbecuing, so I didn't take pictures. This is an IKEA. What's interesting is Japanese people often have T-shirts with either English or German writing, and they usually don't make a lot of sense, but this made sense, so I decided to take a picture of that. Okay, back to the slides. Of course, whenever you build a larger building in Japan today, you have to make it earthquake-proof. That's especially important if your computer costs $1.2 billion. And so this facility is no exception. When we were talking about high-performance computing networks, I did tell you that when we were looking at the 3D tours, which was somewhat complicated to think how to wire it without using really long cables, I did tell you that we would take a look also at five-dimensional and six-dimensional torus networks. And this system has a 6D torus. And it's actually not that complicated. You just have to imagine it as a very small 3D torus, which you can see here, connected in a superimposed 3D torus. So you just take 12 nodes, connect them via a 3D torus, and then, which is sort of trivial because in some dimensions we only have two nodes, in one dimension we have three nodes, so that's still acceptable. And then you use this sort of building block, this node group torus network, in a larger 3D torus. So again, here what you can see is a 3D torus network, and each node here consists of a 3D torus, which is what we call a node group. So it's not really that complicated, but it means that there are a lot of redundant connections here. And this is actually very good because the system itself, as any larger system today, has a pronounced error rate. So some nodes will fail if you are doing a full system run. But what they are really good at is isolating faults. So if you're running a smaller job on the system and you know that some node has failed, you can isolate this node rather well so that signals can just pass by and won't be affected by the faulty node. So this is one of the actual architectural benefits of this machine. Usually it's not a big selling factor because many people are still basing their purchase decisions on performance, absolute performance, peak performance, and performance per watt perhaps, or performance per dollar, while fault tolerance is sort of a usability factor, which ends up usually as something, well, that's something you can blame on the user, or that is a user burden to work around. It's also hard to quantify fault tolerance. The network they were using was a custom designed network. It was not InfiniBand. So the basis of the network was this NIC, was this special chip interconnect controller. I think on the previous slide it was abbreviated as ICC, which has its own communication engines and links. These should be, I think, 12 links, somewhat, maybe just 11 links. Let's count those. I think the X, Y, and Z links are from the larger 3D torus network. And we have A, B plus, B minus, and C. Those links are for the node group. And you might now think, why don't we have six links for the node group if we have six links for the superordinate 3D torus? And the reason for that is our node group consists of just 12 nodes. And if we are building a 3D torus for this, some of my dimensions simply have just two nodes. So, for instance, if I assume that this here is my A direction and this here is my C direction, I just need one link to get to my neighboring nodes, right? But if this here is my B direction, then each node will need a link to the above node and one to the node below, and vice versa. So that's the reason why we just have 10 links here and not 12. Okay, I would say this is a pretty standard die print. Not too many surprises here. Well, perhaps there's one surprise. I think if you look at current Intel server, Intel Xeon CPUs, there's more die space spent on the cache. And very little die space spent on the cache controller. And does anyone know why the cache controller here is so large? One reason is the cache actually is configurable. You can configure parts of the cache to be to be accessible via a special address, so that it can function as a sort of a scratch pad. And it won't work as a cache. You can think of that as a local store in the cell CPU, or local memory in a GPU. Shared memory, actually, it's called in CUDA. So this design has 8 cores, which doesn't look very impressive, but each of those cores is a vector core, so it has a lot more functional units inside. So each core itself has 256 floating point registers, which are actually available to the programmer, which is convenient, and it can perform 8 floating point operations per clock per core. So that's 4 double precision fused multiply adds. I think that is half of what current Intel CPUs can do, but of course, Intel CPUs are now much newer than the K processor design, which is now a bit older. Each had 32 kilobytes of level 1 cache, which is not too much. Level 2 cache is also not very large. What's interesting here is Intel is usually using level 1, 2, and 3, where level 1 and 2 cache are for one core, and level 3 cache is shared. And in this case, we have a level 2 cache, which is shared among the nodes. So the programmer has to watch how to move data between memory and the core much more closely than for Intel hardware, because there's simply less cache available. But as I said before, level 2 cache is sectored, so or partitioned, and can be used as a scratch pad if needs, if the programmer can actually make use of that. So this is a quick diagram of how the architecture looks like. This is again RISC CPU, so we have dedicated write and load and store units again, which the programmer has to use. Other than that, I think there's not too much of a surprise here. Sadly, I don't know if it is out of order execution or in order execution. Okay, so that's already it for the K computer. I don't have an account for that machine, so if any one of you should ever know someone who knows how to get an account there without being Japanese, please tell me. I would really be interested in the architecture itself. So next system on the top 500 list was Sequoia. Sequoia should, even though we don't, yeah, please. That's a good question. Actually, there are different schools of thought. So historically, the codes which run on a supercomputer are much older than the supercomputer. So a lot of the codes which are used in the US, for instance, for nuclear weapons stewardship, are already 2 or 3 decades old. Or one code which I'm currently working on is ADCIRC. That is a code, I think I did show you some Fortran before the Christmas break, that is also from the 1980s, with a large fraction written in the 90s. But in any case, it is already 20 years old. So a lot of the code is in Fortran, it's old code. there's usually not a new compiler for every machine, but they tend to modify compilers for special purpose processors. So for instance, on BlueJean, you should be using the IBM compiler, which is capable of optimizing code for the hardware. The problem is, for instance, the next system we will be looking at is an IBM system again, and IBM's C++ compiler, which is called XLC++, it knows the hardware for which it's generating code very well. The problem is it doesn't know C++ all too well, which is not very good if you're trying to compile C++ code. I think IBM has a better Fortran compiler. Usually the codes you're trying to compile are either odd tools based, so that you don't have any specialized IDE for that. You just access the computer via SSH and copy your code there and hope that the AutoTools will select the correct compiler. And so what the vendor is doing is optimizing the compiler for the architecture. If it is a special architecture, if it's running Intel architecture, then you'll probably be using the Intel compiler. What vendors typically do is they modify the MPI implementation to tune it to the network interconnect which you are using. So these are the two typical modifications a vendor will do. Regarding the codes, yeah, as I said, there are different schools of thought. The one school thinks, just leave the codes alone and hope that the compiler will do most of the optimization. Perhaps sprinkle some pragmas where you hope that the compiler should be able to either vectorize the code or offload it to an accelerator like the Xeon Phi or NVIDIA GPU. The other school of thought thinks we should modernize our codes simply because expecting the compiler to transform a program which was written for a 1990 CPU to a 2015 supercomputer is probably not very reasonable. So actually, that's what I think as well. We should modernize a lot of our codes so that the architecture of the code reflects the architectures on which it is supposed to run. So one thing modern systems all have in common is they have a lot of different levels of parallelism. And typically, we don't see those in the codes. The codes often look like they were written for a scalar CPU, and somewhere someone took out some scissors and did cut the code into smaller pieces to make them parallelizable via MPI. But this parallelization is usually not suitable for fine-grained parallelism as found on multicores. So then later on, someone else went ahead and did add some OpenMP pragmas, which sometimes works, sometimes not. So, yeah.
So to sum up my question, it really depends who's in charge, how much money they get, what kind of compilers are already free or available or on the market, and what kind of hardware are
you. Exactly. So, to move one slide back, for this system, Fujitsu did build their own C++ compiler, and I tried to compile my libgeodcomp, my own software for that. They had an offer to do that during, I think, SC12. And we sat down for 2 hours, and basically the outcome was it was not working at all. That was a bit frustrating. So that's also one reason why I would be interested in testing my code again there, because I hope that they sort of improved their C++ compiler. For Sequoia, which is a BlueJean Q, you could use XLC++. I did write a couple of bug reports. I wasn't using Sequoia, but I was using uQueen, which is a BlueJean Q located in Jülich in Germany. And they were pretty fixed, pretty fast to fix the bugs. So right now you can use libgeodcomp with XLC++. But I think the preferred way to port code to BlueJean Q today is to use GCC or Clang. So both compilers have been ported to BlueJean Q, and today you can run codes via them. we'll see later on this architecture that there are some peculiarities of the architecture which are probably not reflected best by these compilers, but it is always a trade-off. Sometimes it's better to use a not that efficient compiler to have a code which is running than to use a very efficient compiler which can't compile your code, right? Also, one interesting point regarding your question is that you probably know that we have fast computers here, but they are not that fast that they would be in the top 10 of the top 500 list. But what's interesting is that in Erlang, we spend more money on optimizing code. So we don't have that large machines, but we usually have a lot of publications on international conferences regarding tuning and optimization and performance modeling of high-performance computing codes. So if you go to any international conference, chances are that people will know your institution because there are a lot of people from Erlang at the conferences. And I think at the SC14, there were, do you know how many people from Erlang were there? Was it 1 dozen or 2 dozen of people?
At least 1 dozen.
Yeah. Okay. If you count all the chairs and all the student volunteers and it was a lot of people. But it's a difficult question on which to spend money. Do you spend it on people or do you spend it on machines? And somewhere you have to find a compromise. Anyhow, let's continue with the discussion of the Sequoia architecture. It was the fastest system for, again, just half a year. It was, again, much faster than K computer, 60% faster than the initial about twice as fast as the initial performance of the K computer, which was 8.5, and about 60% faster than the final performance. It was located at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. I think that's where Roadrunner was also located. And again, it's built by IBM. If you would compare node boards from BlueJean Q and BlueJean P, I think it wouldn't see a lot of difference. What's new is probably the water cooling. I don't think that the previous designs were water cooled. If you look at the die chart, what's the first thing you see is there are a lot of more cores. I think the previous design was just a quad core design, and suddenly we have 18 cores. 18 cores is probably not a number you would expect. And this architecture was published, people were still thinking we would see always powers of two for core counts on multi-cores. The reason is, actually, while they chose 18, they wanted to be able to disable one core to increase their yield. If you know about manufacturing of integrated circuits, then you probably know that some chips you produce simply are faulty, not because your manufacturing process is faulty, but because there's simply a certain error rate. So some chips are bound to have errors. And if your chip is only working if all the transistors are working, then your yield will probably be rather low. But if your chip is still working, even though one of the cores has been disabled, let's say just one of the cores here is not working, then you suddenly have a huge increase in yield. The reason why they added not just one core, so that they would be at 17 cores, but another core to be at 18 cores, is they wanted one core to use as a supervisor. There's also one more reason to have another core. Usually you don't need too much compute power to do supervising. I mean, what would you do if the whole CPU usually just spends its time on one node? But you can also do other tasks with this extra core, like I/O or MPI pacing. So actually, this core looks at all the data that needs to be transferred via MPI and is transferring that while the other 16 cores are computing. This is an architectural benefit compared to current Intel designs, where you typically try to use all cores for computing. And if you do asynchronous communication via MPI, you have to somehow figure out a way yourself to make this work in a non-blocking asynchronous way. This is a picture I took at, I think, SC11. Yeah, back then it was still confidential. You can still read this on the slides, but I think I'm now allowed to publish those, especially because the architecture has been disclosed by many other publications. This is a summary of how the chip of the BlueJeanQ is actually structured. And unlike many other designs we've seen before, it's not using a ring bus to connect all cores, but it's actually a crossbar. So you can see here, 16. These should be 16 cores which are used for computing. This is one supervisor core. It's again based on the PowerPC architecture, but with a wider floating point unit. So that's something it has in common with previous BlueJeanQ designs. And here we have the level 2 cache, which consists of multiple partitions. Each partition is 2 megabytes in size, and connected to the cache are 2 DDR3 controllers. If you compare this to, let's say, the Spark architecture we've seen before, the Spark architecture had 5 megabytes per chip for level 2 cache. And here we have 16 partitions, each of which is 2 megabytes, so that's 32 megabytes of level 2 cache. And that's quite a bit more. So you can expect that you can do a lot of other calculations here in cache compared to the Spark CPU. The reason why IBM is able to add so much cache is, I think I did mention it previously, they have a manufacturing process where they are able to embed DRAM into the logic of the chip. So they are able to combine DRAM and the DRAM manufacturing process with the logic manufacturing process. I should probably say they were able to do that because they are selling off their chip business. So they don't have any fabs. They won't have any fabs soon anymore. What's really interesting about the network here is the network is directly on die. So the network interconnect, I think that was the case also on previous BlueJean iterations. They don't have some sort of PCI Express InfiniBand card where the data arrives at the InfiniBand card, then needs to traverse the PCI Express bus and then needs to move through the memory controller into the DRAM and back from the DRAM to the cache. But here, data arrives directly on the crossbar of the CPU and is pushed into the cache. So if some CPU is directly consuming this data, the data probably never needs to move to level to the DRAM. So that's a lot more efficient, and also it cuts down latency because the data has to traverse less positions or less stations in the system. And again, we have an hierarchical design. Of course, you don't have to remember all these numbers, right? So I won't ever ask someone how many I/O drawers does a BlueJeanQ rack have or something like that, because that's simply not interesting. What's probably interesting is to ask what kind of network is a BlueJeanQ using. So if you would answer that's a fat tree, that would probably not be right, because actually it's a 5-dimensional torus. That is, again, similar to the 6-dimensional torus we've seen before. It's simply a 3-dimensional torus connected from smaller torus networks. Oh, yeah. What I should note is that I/O nodes are connected via QDR InfiniBand. So InfiniBand is used to connect the... we are using PCI Express to connect the I/O nodes, and InfiniBand is used to connect the I/O nodes to the storage network. So it's sort of convenient for InfiniBand to be scalable, at least to a certain degree. And yeah, as you can see here again, a different strategy for I/O. In this case, we have dedicated I/O nodes, but you shouldn't concentrate data here as far as I know, but you should move data in a coordinated fashion through the I/O nodes. Okay. Next system now is the Titan system. I think it was replaced as the fastest system quickly after that. What's interesting here is not just that it is a hybrid system. It's not the first hybrid system in the top 500. It's also not the first number one system, because that was Zhonghe 1A. What's interesting here is that's basically an update of the Jaguar system. So if you look at the racks closely, you will see that the racks are still the same they were using for Jaguar. They were just replacing the nodes themselves inside the system. So the system itself is based on AMD Bulldozer chips. I think that was the last large system from Cray, which was built with AMD chips. Today, all the systems you can buy from Cray are Intel chips. And the reason was not really that AMD processors back then were the best choice, but simply because the network interconnect Cray had designed was connected via hypertransport to the cores, and of course Intel chips did not feature hypertransport, so they couldn't switch vendors quickly. The theoretical peak performance was 27 petaflops, and it was, I think it was designed to deliver at least 20 petaflops in the Linpack benchmark. So someone ended up with 17 petaflops. I'm not sure they were really satisfied with that. But yeah, that's sort of the number they had. I had an account pretty quickly on that machine because I was lucky to meet the scientific director of Oak Ridge, someone in Hamburg. So the director has a certain budget of computer time which he can choose to distribute to different projects. So I was lucky to get some time then. But I did also get a lot of emails that the system is down. So if you have an account on that system, you will get an email whenever the system crashes. And that used to happen on a daily basis initially. It was really, really bad. And the reason is not just that it had so many nodes, but there was another problem with the system. They had too much gold in the contacts on the main boards, which would contact the NVIDIA GPUs. And you would now think there can never be too much gold, but in this case, actually, the gold caused connection problems. So the electrical quality of the link between the motherboard and the GPU was not as good as it had to be. So the solution to this problem was they simply replaced all the main boards. Not exactly cheap, but if you're paying a couple hundred of millions for the system, someone needs to make this work. Do you remember what the performance was of Sequoia? I think 16.5 petaflops. So this is just marginally faster. It's really just a very small step up. So what I thought afterwards was maybe there was some communication between Oak Ridge and Livermore, because if Titan had been online half a year earlier, then Sequoia would never have been the number one system on any list. So I'm not sure. Yeah, as I said, I read somewhere that they recycled the racks, but simply added different intestines to it. Also, they were again using a 3D torus network, but this time not the Starfish network, but Gemini, which is again an ASIC, so an application-specific integrated circuit. So a differentiating factor for Cray was for a long time that they were not just running their own software, but also their own hardware for the network. They did sell off the hardware branch to Intel. So what they are expecting to do for their next designs is to simply buy this interconnect technology from Intel, because it should already be integrated into the Intel chips. And what you can see for upcoming Intel server chips, I think from Broadwell on, is that the interconnect, at least something which is compatible with InfiniBand, is already integrated into the Intel Xeon core. So there will probably no longer be PCI Express cards. which is of course a problem if you are an InfiniBand vendor. Right? So if you look at the Open Power Consortium, Open Power is sort of a unification of companies which are competing with Intel. So one company in here is obviously IBM, huge system and CPU vendor, which is afraid that Intel might outpace it. Actually, it is. Intel is already outpacing it. So if you look at the IBM systems, most of the current still IBM systems are very large systems, and the systems IBM previously built, which were used for the top 500, are now owned by Lenovo. Right? Lenovo bought the server business from IBM. So Open Power consists of IBM and NVIDIA. Of course, NVIDIA is competing with Intel because Intel now tries to replace NVIDIA cards in high-performance computing with their own Intel Xeon Phi design. And there's Mellanox. Mellanox is a company from Israel, which is manufacturing. I think there are also a lot of other companies inside, but these are probably the major players. Mellanox is an InfiniBand vendor. So of course, they are now afraid that newer Intel systems would ship without their InfiniBand hardware. We will see. OK, if we look at a blade design from Titan, we can see here that on a blade, we have four nodes. We have four CPUs and four GPUs. And I have to admit that I do always forget which is which. So I think these are the CPUs and these are the GPUs, because they are connected next, because they are located next to the RAM. And this looks a bit like sort of PCI Express slots. But it's hard to say. So I'm not 100% sure, just 80% sure. Okay, per node, we also have, that's basically what we see also on the K computer. We have a dedicated network chip, which I think we can see here. The whole drawer, the whole blade is air-cooled, so we no liquid cooling in this case, which already leads us to our next subject, GPUs. To recap why, yeah, please. So water cooling actually is expensive. Yeah, you're right. There was a particular problem for the Leibniz Rechenzentrum in Munich when they set up SuperMUC, because they had to be sure that each rack had the same resistance to the water pressure, so to make sure that each rack received the same flow rate. So they spend a lot of effort to set up the cooling system. The reason why people are doing that is actually to save money. So even though it's complicated to set up and takes a while and you have to use expensive equipment to do so, power is expensive in many countries. Perhaps not so much in the US, but it's very expensive in Europe, at least in Germany. And so if you think about the whole process of purchasing and running a supercomputer, today the cost you spend for power and for cooling is about half of that budget. So it's not really, it's not, it used to be just about the hardware you're buying, but today operating costs are so high that you are happy to lower the cost, the power consumption. And with water cooling, people can usually achieve a much lower operational cost because you don't need to cool down air, you don't need to move the air very fast everywhere. Water can move slower, and it's also good. It's also more efficient to take up the heat. So that's typically the reason why people are using air cooling. The good thing is, it in a physical sense, it does scale very well. But that's not because we have so many water cooled systems. But actually, water cooling is used in industry. So if you take a look at car manufacturing, you have these large presses, I don't know in English, the machines which manufacture the car parts, which are stamping them out from metal. They get very hot, and usually you don't want your Mercedes to look different if it's built from parts stamped in the morning or from parts stamped in the evening, because the machine got hot and they produce slightly different parts, right? So they are cooling down these systems with water cooling. And so the same technology which is used in heavy industries is now also used for HPC systems. That's why they have this, for instance, these drop-free pipes readily available. They could just reuse it from heavy industry. Yeah. Does it answer your question? Cool. Okay, so why are we looking at GPUs? We should recap that this is a supercomputer, the fastest supercomputer built at that time. But what we have here in the GPUs is essentially hardware with very few modifications, which was initially built to power your gaming PC, right? So it was not initially intended to be used for scientific calculations. And the reason why people were suddenly using this hardware for scientific computations was it was surprisingly well suited for that purpose. It was, when I began to study parallel computing, people were simply wowed by the fact that you could compute something on a GPU, right? Because people were perceiving those as pure gaming devices. And actually, that's also what we saw in the history of GPUs. Initially, there was no term GPU. That's actually a term introduced later on. Initially, it was called video card. So, you know, video card or graphic card in German. There was really just a connector between the computer and the screen. So it was not intelligent back then. One problem of a PC was always an expensive piece of hardware. It was initially used in offices for businesses which could afford that. So people usually did not have a PC at home. They had a home computer, hence the name home computer. It was not a PC. One problem besides the price tag PCs had was they weren't well suited for games. They were really slow. And even the arcade and home computers in the 1980s had 2D acceleration. Actually, the arcade computers had this before, but in the 1980s, the GPUs or the video cards of PCs caught up with that. So you could run simple 2D games with that somewhat efficiently. That was not perfect, but it was a huge step up, right? In the 1990s, we saw the first 3D accelerators. So did any one of you have a Matrox Mystique or a 3DFX Voodoo card? Nice. I think I still have. Sorry? I think 3DFX was later on bought by NVIDIA. So if you have now multiple NVIDIA GPUs, you can connect them via an SLI cable. And 3DFX Voodoo had this first, but back then this really meant scanline interleave. So you had two GPUs, and the cable would run from one GPU to the other GPU and then to the monitor. And actually, both GPUs were computing the same picture, but just interleaved by one scan line. The cable connecting both GPUs had to be very short so that the quality you were seeing on the monitor would not be degraded too much. So no one would ever build such a system again, but back then that was really exciting. The problem was there was no standard for programming these GPUs. So some games would be ported to the Matrox interface, some games would be ported to 3DFX programming interface. I think it was it called Glide or something like that? Doesn't really matter. So most games were not compatible with all cards. So basically, people were buying the card which did support their favorite games. Initially, what they did was just polygon rastering. So you gave them a texture and you gave them the vertices of a polygon, let's say of a triangle or of a quad. And then they would just match the texture to these new coordinates. Very simple. Yet it was a huge step up. It did deliver graphics which we weren't used from PCs. Yeah, okay. So 3DFX was Glide and Matrox Simple Interface was from Matrox. Actually, Matrox does still exist. They make GPUs for business PCs. Also some embedded GPUs, so some of our server boards have some sort of Matrox chip on them, but it's no longer the high performance cards you were used to. Today they have more or less been replaced by NVIDIA. Okay, in the early 1990s, of course, people wanted a unified programming interface for these graphics cards, so people first used OpenGL. One problem of OpenGL was used in professional applications like computer-aided design, CAD, and for this, usually people had to buy very expensive GPUs. And it would, of course, be unthinkable to buy a cheap 200 DM device which could be used in CAD, right? That would destroy the whole CAD market. So manufacturers didn't provide a full OpenGL driver, but just a small installable client driver for OpenGL, which featured a subset of OpenGL, so that gaming devices really couldn't be used for CAD, at least not in the initial sense. Microsoft, of course, did realize, oh, here's a market. It's a market for games. Games have always been written for MS-DOS. Now they were being written for Microsoft Windows. That was basically the time where the switch from DOS to Windows occurred. And they thought, okay, if we can capture everyone to use our standard for 3D programming, we can bind them all to our Microsoft Windows system. Because back then there were also IBM DOS and DR DOS, so DOS systems not manufactured by Microsoft. And initially, this Direct3D was really inferior to OpenGL, and people did hate it. Also, John Carmack, which you probably know from id Software, did hate Direct3D. But then Microsoft did something unusual for Microsoft. They decided to not just release updates, but they also dropped backwards compatibility. So they did let Direct3D evolve very quickly. And today, a lot of game developers say that Direct3D is the better interface compared to OpenGL. I cannot comment on that because I have no experience with Direct3D, so I don't know. But that was untypical for Microsoft to drop backwards compatibility. I think they have achieved the goal because most games are still being written for Direct3D and not for OpenGL, even though there are just very few architectures which run Direct3D. If you think about architectures or gaming devices, we have, let's say, Android. We have all the mobile devices, iOS. Windows, 8. Is the Windows they use on the phones, is it also called Windows 8 or is it called Windows Phone 8 or Windows Phone? Okay. Windows Phone, what do we have? We have, of course, Windows for the stationary systems. Windows 8, Linux. OS X for Macs. And we have PlayStation. PlayStation and we have Xbox. I'm not sure about Windows Phone, but Windows 8 and Xbox, they do, of course, run Direct3D. Probably this one too, I'm not sure. But all other architectures run OpenGL. And still, most games are being written for Direct3D, which tells you how much, how successful Microsoft's strategy in this case was. Anyhow, if we look at the hardware, more functionality was moved to the GPU. So, for instance, the GeForce 256, that was able to also do coordinate transformation and lightning calculation in the hardware, which of course was a huge step up. Because then you could use the CPU for other stuff like artificial intelligence or sound processing. Also, I think this is the first GPU for which the term was used. Initially, that was a marketing term, but then everyone in the market used that term. Also, initially, what was used was a fixed function pipeline, so that is Direct3D 10. And all games had to use this fixed function pipeline. So they first had to use vertex shader, geometry shader, pixel shader, and you were not really free to program the hardware you wanted to do. So the initial programs which we could write for the shaders were really just lists of instructions. There were no conditionals, there were no loops until 2002. When the first Radeon 9700 was released, and this was suddenly able to do loops, and this enabled programmers to write different programs for the GPUs, so they could write more complicated or more capable calculations. This stuff, of course, did continue quickly. So since 2010, shaders are Turing complete. You can pretty much do any calculation you want to on the GPU. And this was also the first point where when people realized, oh, maybe we can do scientific calculations on the GPU. The big players which we still have are, well, I should update that slide, AMD and NVIDIA. Although it's probably misleading to list Intel as a minor player. Intel is not producing discrete GPUs, but nearly every CPU you can buy today from Intel, at least for notebooks, has a GPU built in. And if you look at the latest Broadwell dies, which you can buy today, a dual-core Broadwell will look like this. Here you have the two compute cores, you have some cache, and this is all GPU. So they spend about 60% of the die space on the GPU. So I would say Intel is also a big player in GPUs today, even though they have a different focus. Their goal is probably more to not force everyone to buy a discrete GPU any longer. Maybe if that has the benefit of destroying AMD or NVIDIA, that would be nice for Intel as well. But they are not really into delivering prime GPU, simply because even though this is the majority of the die, it's still much less capable than a huge discrete GPU. Okay. What's also perhaps known by few is PowerVR. That's the chip. That's a manufacturer which is delivering GPUs or GPU designs for many mobile For instance, Apple devices, but I think also, I'm not sure if my mobile phone also has a PowerVR chip. They used to build discrete GPUs for PCs, but that is probably 15 years ago. So they stopped doing this simply because the market pressure was too high. In 2008, the first CUDA release was published. Does anyone know what people were using before CUDA was published to do calculations on the GPU? They were using OpenGL. So actually you can do simple calculations in OpenGL and just treat the data you're moving onto the GPU as some sort of texture which you're modifying and then interpret the data differently if you're moving it back. So it is really a hack, and the first programs were written in OpenGL for GPUs, for scientific calculations. When NVIDIA realized that this actually has a lot of potential, they were developing CUDA to aid in these calculations to make it less difficult to code for GPUs. And I think the first real breakthrough was the Tesla C1060 in around 2009. I think it was announced earlier, but really available only a year later. Which was bought by a lot of institutions, including ours, to do GPU programming. There was a huge hype around that topic, around that date. And we also had a system basically on our desk. So I'm sharing an office with a colleague, and between our two desks, we had the system with three GPUs inside. And it was rather quiet if it was idling. But if we were running a code on all three GPUs, all the fans would speed up, and of course the GPUs were mounted very closely together, so there was hardly any air passing between the fans, so it got really hot. And the sound was that of two vacuum cleaners on the desk turned to maximum power, so it was really noisy. And that was also the reason why it wasn't quickly moved to our server room. It was just not, it was not tolerable. The reason why all the scientific computing devices you can buy today from NVIDIA are called Tesla was the microarchitecture of this card was called Tesla. And they decided to keep this marketing brand. So even though the later cards you could buy had a Fermi microarchitecture or today Kepler microarchitecture, they are still, the cards themselves are still called Tesla C2050 or whatever you can buy today, K20, K40, K80. In this case, the K probably translates to Kepler. I'm not sure where they had the Fermi. So Fermi was also very important for supercomputers. Fermi was used in the Tsubame supercomputer, and I think it was also used for, let me skip back. I'm not sure if it was used for Titan. No, I think for Titan they already used Kepler. I'm not sure right now. Okay, here we are. Interestingly, AMD or ATI's designs were usually more accomplished for GPU computing, but the software support and the general support from AMD was rather limited compared to NVIDIA. I think NVIDIA has a lot of more people who are working on supporting people using their hardware for scientific calculations, and for AMD it always feels like they were treating it as a gimmick. So, for instance, if you are running a server with an AMD card and you want to give people access to this AMD card, you have to also install an X server, even though no one's actually using this graphical user interface. And the reason is all the OpenCL calculations are done by forwarding them to the OpenGL driver, and you can only do this if there's an X server running. But of course, the X server has its own access rights management. And usually you won't allow anyone to draw on any X device because that's also accessible via the network, and you don't want anyone to connect you to your server or to your notebook and draw anything he wants to draw on your notebook display, right? I had a colleague who was working at IBM, and this actually happened to him unintentionally. So he was connected to a server and was working there and had some windows open, and suddenly an editor popped open with a file he didn't know, and it turned out to be from his boss, and the X system was misconfigured to show that data to him, which of course he was not allowed to see, but anyhow. So what you have to do, what I want to say is, if you're running an AMD card inside a server, you have to give everyone on that system access to the X system. So that is sort of an open door. It is difficult to justify that from a system administrator's perspective. It's not really nice. This is actually an older slide, so I would rephrase this question. What we will see what we are currently seeing from AMD's designs is that they are integrating the ATI graphics cores with their own CPU cores, and they have a problem that their GPU cores are somewhere on par with NVIDIA's designs, but their CPU cores are subpar compared with Intel. But their hope is, even though their CPU cores may be somewhat slower than Intel's cores, maybe they can offload, in these fusion designs, maybe they can offload floating point calculations to the GPU part and then keep up with Intel. I think that's working very well for low-cost notebooks, low-cost and low-power notebooks. The problem is that because Intel is actually catching up, at least for mobile processors, with the GPU performance, they are somewhat pressed in the market, because from the bottom, Intel is advancing with increasing GPU performance, and on the top of the market, you have Intel notebooks with discrete NVIDIA GPUs, which are even faster than the Fusion chips you can buy from AMD. So I think it's still a difficult decision for AMD. I think they still... I'm curious how their next designs will look like, because in theory, they could add so much faster GPUs to their designs. And simultaneously, Intel is really struggling to deliver GPUs which are somewhere on par with a discrete GPU. Right now they can't do. And the problem NVIDIA has, they have no CPU core. They couldn't build a system where the cores, they cannot build a chip where the cores and the GPU are integrated. You can see this for embedded designs. So if you look at NVIDIA Tegra designs, they already have an ARM CPU integrated. In a sense, IBM has also opened its power design. So in theory, NVIDIA could add a power core to their NVIDIA GPUs. I'm not sure if they really plan to do that, because the larger supercomputers which they plan to build have both chips connected via sort of a beefed up PCI Express bus. So we will see. So what I want to say is AMD is simultaneously in a very interesting position, but also in a very challenging position. So I don't feel competent to predict the future. But we can take a look briefly at GPU architectures and, please.
I have one more question to the topic where the GPU is part of the CPU chip.
Yeah. So,
the other card was really complicated, but one statement that is made was that there was some kind of company they wanted to do DDR5 RAM, which GPUs are using right now on their own board,
Okay, so we have basically we have two different memory technologies right now on the market. One is DDR and the other one is GDDR, which sort of sounds like the same thing but still is different. Most GPUs use GDDR, which is, I think, simply double data rate RAM and graphics double data rate RAM. And the GDDR technology usually has a higher bandwidth. That's the reason why GPUs have something like 200 gigabytes per second RAM bandwidth, while CPUs still have, I think flagship Intel CPUs right now have something around 65, 68 gigabytes per second. So it's still just a fraction of what GPUs are delivering. But aside from the bandwidth, one other problem is these have a very high latency, around a couple hundred cycles, while these are at most 100 cycles of latency. If you add this to the different programming models, for CPUs where you're using DDR, you usually have one or two threads per core, and they are really fucked if they have to wait for latency, right? So that's the reason why you have so large caches, to minimize the cache miss rate. Typical codes have a cache miss rate somewhere around 0.0 something percent, right? It's really low. So if they were using GDDR, they would have to wait even longer. While on the GPU, your programming model is usually in such a way that you have thousands of threads, so you can tolerate waiting for hundreds of cycles because you have so many other threads which you need to work on before. So, interesting question. Which technology should you use? If we look at the Xbox versus PlayStation, so we have PlayStation and Xbox, if you compare those, both are using basically the same hardware for GPU and for CPU, but PlayStation is using GDDR, while Xbox is using DDR RAM. And I think currently it's working out for the PlayStation. Well, PlayStation developers have more memory bandwidth to use, so certain codes are running better. And because the AMD chip still has a last level cache, latency doesn't end up being such a large problem for the CPU. Another problem here is, to end this question, the connections. GDDR usually has to be soldered onto the board, while DDR can be put into memory banks where you can exchange the memory modules. I think it's down to the electrical specifications. They are so tight for GDDR that you cannot afford sockets. And usually for PC, you are used to have to be able to choose the amount of memory you want on your mainboard. You don't want to throw out your mainboard just because you want a RAM upgrade, even though perhaps manufacturers would love that. What we'll probably see for future Intel designs is that the memory gets moved onto the chip. At least for HPC, the next designs they plan to publish have a 3D memory chip, where you have your usual compute die, and on top of that, you will have a couple of RAM stacks provided by Micron. I'm not sure if they are using DDR or GDDR, but because they are on basically in the same package, they will be able to use a lot more bandwidth because they have a lot more connections. So the data connections don't have to run off chip. So I think we will see some sort of convergence between the memory technologies for CPUs and for GPUs. I'm not so sure about the latency, though. So maybe there will be even more problems for CPUs. Good question. Thanks. Okay, I think we ran out of time. Thank you very much for your attention, and see you tomorrow in the exercise.